now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is a podcast from The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Hi, I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and welcome to the Game Podcast. This week, I'm delighted to be joined on the phone by two very hard northern types, George Culkin and, of course, Matt Hughes, and also Alison Rudd in the studio.
I'm a hard northern type, too.
Yes, as one can tell from your accent.
Bath grass.
Ordinarily, as you know, we would be looking at two football matches in our initial talking point segment, and then going with a debate. But because our producer Chris Skinner has decided to be all London centric, we're going to start at the top with the departure of Andre Villas-Boas. And who better to start with than Matt Hughes, the man who in Monday's Times told us that Harry Redknapp is the shock name for Chelsea. But Matt, I want to take a step back. What's your understanding of the circumstances of Villas-Boas' departure?
Well, he was made to take training yesterday morning, and then he was about 12:30, 12:45, called to a brief meeting with Roman Abramovich, Eugene Tenenbaum, his sort of closest advisor, and Ron Goller, chief executive, and they told him in pretty blunt terms that although they were sorry he'd be leaving, it wasn't working and he had to go. But then went and briefed Di Matteo, who was invited to take over, or probably told to take over, and then they went and spoke to the players, and Roman gave them a bit of a rocket for their efforts this season, which if you've watched Chelsea is probably much deserved.
What do you mean he was made to take training? Wasn't he planning on taking training?
What I mean is he wasn't told he was going to be sacked after the game, which is when the decision had been made, so he had to kind of go through the charade of taking charge of a group of players who pretty much knew that he was on his way out.
Now, Matt, obviously you've got a pretty clear line in there that the way this is being spun immediately, and I think regular listeners will know my viewpoint on this, is that it's all the players' fault, and Abramovich is mad because he sacks managers again and again. In fact, you know, the little wind-up doll that is Richard Bevan has come out already and made that very same point, like he always does when a manager is removed. But what's your take on it? Because obviously responsibility needs to be shared around, but it looks to me like Villas-Boas is pretty rubbish compared to Chelsea's previous manager.
Yeah, he's got a lot wrong. I think the ultimate responsibility lies with Abramovich for appointing the wrong man, but also sacking Ancelotti for no real reason last year, which all stems back to his bizarre decision to dismiss Roy Wilkins in mid-season. Having said that, Villas-Boas has to take his share of the responsibility. He's made some very odd decisions, and ultimately he's been let down by his failure to bond with the players, and maybe even not trying. He was very aloof at the training ground. He was trying to sort of play the hard man to assert himself, to make up for his lack of age and lack of experience, and it's backfired really, because the players have not been playing for him for some time, and I think there's an element of they just didn't understand what he was trying to get at. He's a man who has come from an academic background and has very well studied in the science of the sport, and he used lots of management business jargon which in a football dressing room left them baffled, quite frankly.
I mean, I read your stuff today, Matt, and obviously I'm from the outside, but it just seems that the whole club is completely sort of dysfunctional from top to bottom. I mean, I kind of have I sort of have sympathy for all elements to a small degree, apart from Abramovich, I think, because, you know, if you're going to appoint this young guy and pay such a lot of money to buy him out of his contract and give him the job, then you have to stick by him and give him the tools to get on with the job. I mean, I kind of understand why senior players would be unhappy after kind of giving so much over the last few years and being such an important part of the club, but I just can't kind of get my head around the whole process of going through that whole thing, and at the end of it, just letting him go after 6 months or
but
whatever.
But why, Georgia? Wasn't it? I mean, when you think about it, right? I'm going to play devil's advocate for a change, but you've gone out, you've taken this guy with almost no experience, you said, we believe in you enough that we're going to pay $50 million to bring you on board. All we expect is that you rejuvenate the team while giving it some kind of identity on the pitch and stay in the top four, which is where Chelsea have been for, you know, well, since Roman Abramovich took over in 2003. Yeah, well, why is that so unreasonable?
I don't think that's unreasonable, but if you're talking about, I mean, everyone knows that the problems that Chelsea have got kind of on the pitch. They're an aging team. They've got facets of the team that kind of don't relate to any others. I mean, you know, no one knows who's kind of signing the players. Is it managers? Or is it directors? That's what I'm sort of talking about. I can sort of understand the principle of giving a young guy who's dynamic and has a great, you know, sort of promising CV to do the job of root and branch reform. I can't understand the point of getting shot of him within 6 months. I mean, yeah, I'm not saying that he's covered himself in glory, because I don't think he has, but I can't understand the appointment in the first place in that case.
Matt,
I think what's unreasonable is he was asked to do two contradictory things. He's asked to get results, but at the same time evolve the team and ship players out. And it's pretty impossible for him to get performances from the likes of Drogba, Lampard, who know they're going to be going at the end of the season, and that is what's done for him, really.
Well, you know, maybe Alex Ferguson might beg to differ. I think Scholes and that Giggs guy both know that they'll be gone at the end of the season, probably, and they still get performances out of him. But then again, there is only one Sir Alex Ferguson, and having done our sort of suck-up segment for the show, I want to... It's just difficult. I mean, right, it's difficult at Chelsea to know who's in charge and how they're in charge. But generally, the impression I was under is that Michael Emanalo plays a big part in the decision making there, and was responsible for bringing Villas-Boas in and for making some of the transfer decisions that we all disagree with. At least I did. Is his rear end on the line at all? Like, I mean, could he go at the end of the season if things don't work out? Or is he just like a fixture there for life?
I don't think so. He seems to have got himself very close to Abramovich and was involved in the talks yesterday morning with Abramovich before they went and met Villas-Boas. So he seems to be pretty firmly entrenched and, for whatever reason, has the ear in his ear.
So will he pick the new boss?
I think Roman will pick the new boss.
Not Emanalo.
No, Emanalo. I mean, Emanalo will have an opinion, but as I'm sure you know, Chelsea is a very fluid club, and it doesn't have what you might call orthodox management structures, and instead it has a series of individuals: Emanalo, Marina, Roman's PA, Ron Goddard, chief executive, Bruce Buckley, chairman, and they all kind of float ideas into Roman, and eventually he just sort of decides.
But doesn't Emanalo just make Abramovich's wishes come true, as opposed to try and influence what Abramovich wants?
He's like a fairy, like godmother or something.
I mean, I didn't. I mean, you know better than me, Matt, but I didn't get the impression that's the intellect behind the club. It's more you keep your job at Chelsea if you say yes, a good deal, to the man with all the money. Isn't that what happened?
Well, him and Avram Grant, for whatever reason, have managed to keep close relations with Abramovich in a way that people haven't, and suggests that he does actually want to be surrounded by yes man. Maybe he's the Phil Neal of the 21st century.
Well, speaking of assistants, Robbie D now in charge. Now, I think everybody's assuming it's just interim till the end of the season, maybe before. But you know, this is a guy who got in the playoffs with a newly promoted MK Dons team, got West Brom promoted, and then halfway through the season things didn't work out, was let go. But he's still young. He speaks 87 bazillion languages. Not only does he have a university degree, he has a higher education degree as well. He's got a master's degree, too. Is there any scenario whereby Robbie D stays in charge after the end of the season? Does he need to win the Champions League?
Pretty much. I think he's in the Avram Grant camp of appointed solely because he's on the spot and available.
So why'd they appoint him in the first place?
Well, they don't have a very sophisticated appointment structure. They basically appoint a player who used to play for a coach who used to play for Chelsea. That's their number two. that's how it works. From Steve Clark, Ray Wilkins, Roberto Di Matteo, they kind of want a figurehead to keep the fans happy and someone with a bit of experience in English football. That was the rationale. I don't think he's made much impact at all on the players this season, and people have even said he's even less popular than the last of us. So it's going to be a very interesting couple of months, or maybe even a couple of weeks.
Where did it happen that it's important for a manager to be popular? I mean, you know, the best teachers at your child's school will be the ones that have a lot of respect, not the ones that the kids think are a great hoot. I mean, a good manager shouldn't be relying upon he gets the job, the first thing you read here, blogged, web, newspapers, radio, television is, oh, players don't like him either. It's just ridiculous.
Well, I mean, maybe it has something to do with the fact that the highest paid manager in the world right now, Jose Mourinho, is all about being popular and his players would run through brick walls for him. But Matt, you drew up a list of candidates. Just very quickly, you just stop me if I'm wrong. Okay, Redknapp will not take the Chelsea job because he will take the England job or take Spurs, correct?
Correct.
Mourinho will not take the Chelsea job because he's burned so many bridges at Stamford Bridge, would have to repair them with so many people, and he's at a bigger club and making more money, and he's got a young team, and all his posturing and pretending to come to London and to look at houses, and he really does come to London, but then he pretends to look at houses. It's all down to getting a new deal with Real Madrid, correct?
I would have thought so, and crucially, he won't get the power he wants. He's got a Madrid at Chelsea. No chance.
Okay, Pep won't take the job because he does this every year. He's all unsure about himself and stuff like that. But he's going to stay at Barcelona, correct?
Or go elsewhere, but certainly not to Chelsea.
Okay, Capello won't get the job because people like you keep saying that he doesn't speak English, correct?
Absolutely.
Okay, so we're kind of burning through your list of options here.
Roberto Matteo it is.
Robbie or Brendan Rodgers?
I think they're looking for a guy with a bit more experience than that, having had their fingers burnt by going for a young former Chelsea coach. You're right, there are very few options out there. And
Davy Moyes?
Once the fantasy list of Guardiola and Mourinho is gone through, it'll be probably less of a choice of a kind of promising coach in Spain or David Moyes, who, if you're looking for a guy to be build long term and not spend too much money, he could be your man.
There you go, David Moyes. You know what? I long argued that they should have been taking a look at him before, certainly at least interviewing him.
What would be interesting is Tottenham are also very keen on Moyes.
Whatever.
If and when they lose Redknapp, so
okay. So it's perfect. Redknapp and Moyes, two managers, two people need managers. You just split them up any way you like, and everybody's happy, right?
No, three people need managers. It's a small matter of the FA.
Yeah, exactly. Then leave Stuart Pearce for the FA. Why not? For some reason, our Tottenham supporting producer has moved some minor match at White Hart Lane to second in the running order ahead of Newcastle v Sunderland. Fortunately, I have the power to turn that around, George. This certainly lived up to expectations, I thought. Every stereotype, everything that we sort of take for granted, from the intensity to the fans and everything. I know it's a very trite thing to say, but it's not always like this, is it?
No, and that was it was a particularly special one, you have to say, in terms of just that, just complete insanity from first minute to last. They're not always. I mean, they're always, you know, they're always intense, they're always noisy, but it just sort of had everything. It was the kind of, you know, cliched sort of derby where you can't take your eyes off it for a minute. Your ears are constantly being pounded, and at the end of it, sort of, you know, and I sort of sat back in the press room. The idea of being able to sort of somehow make sense of it was clearly I didn't manage, but you can't, it's sort of the eardrums are being dented so much, you just can't find room to think. But
George, I thought you did make sense of it, because I thought you indicated in your report that it was mainly about the facts, and then retranced 5-1 in the corresponding fixture last season, and they had to in some way impose themselves on a game that they could have struggled in, and it was almost as though they orchestrated the sort of that sort of utter derbiness about it to make sure that they weren't lost.
Well, it was quite interesting. I mean, I sort of thought when Catamol got booked after 38 seconds, whatever it was, I thought, my God, what an idiot. You know, that's him out of the FA Cup quarter final against Everton. He's now going to have to watch his step for, you know, 90 plus minutes. What an idiot. However, you know, Alan Pardew sort of said later he thought that was sort of a premeditated thing, and it actually set the right tone for Sunderland, because it showed that they weren't going to freeze like they had done the season before after the 5-1, and his teammates sort of responded to it. And actually, in actual fact, you know, I would have kind of given, if I'd had to mark the players after 40 seconds, which of course that would be ridiculous, but, you know, Catamol would have got a 1, but if I'd had to mark him again after 90 minutes, he would have got 8, and then of course he gets sent off in extra time, so he goes back, you know. but and I thought it did set a tone, and it was the kind of the enjoyable thing about it from the neutral's perspective is that it felt like a kind of confrontation between equals, which is far more fun, and with kind of both benches piling into things as well, it was chaotic, the whole thing. It really was.
Now, does Alan Pardew really, really care, or was he trying to wind up Martin O'Neill?
Well, I would like to think that it was just all about getting wound up in the moment. You know, John.
And sorry, could you actually see what happened? Because you see the sequence. I see.
I
watch it on TV, and you see like Pardew jumping around like some kind of demented monkey, but you can't see whether he's just celebrating or whether he's doing it in O'Neill's face. Just O'Neill kind of comes into view later, so it's difficult to kind of.
Well, it all started off from that first, there was a big confrontation of players, and the two benches got involved then, and that was the kind of the first thing. And then every time anything happened on the pitch that was sort of controversial, whether it was a foul or, you know, whatever, they would go at it again. I mean, it's worth pointing out that Newcastle have, you know, John Carver on their coaching staff, who's come back to the club under Pardew, but was a fixture under Sir Bobby and Ruud Gullit and others, and is a Geordie. Steve Stone's there, he's a Geordie, and they just, you know, they all got swept up in it. I mean, I would say I kind of find all that stuff entertaining in some ways. I do think, without wanting to get too kind of po-faced about it, I do think it does, you know, that side of it does set a bit of a bad example kind of for everybody else, because the managers should really be able to kind of rise above it and not kind of get involved in that kind of posturing. Really, it's a bit of cabaret, I suppose, but it's not, I didn't think that was the most edifying thing of it. And Pardew did, I mean, to give him credit, Pardew did come out publicly anyway and apologise for sort of celebrating the penalty, the award of a penalty in front of O'Neill. I didn't think that was great. I'm not sure that there were apologies made in private, but there was certainly, you know, there certainly was a public one, which I think was probably the right thing to do.
And you didn't even mention your friend Andy Woodman, the man who got into it with a senior citizen like Joe Jordan last year, being sent off.
Yeah. They were all...
Is he a Geordie too? Is that his excuse? Or is he just a crazed nutter?
Although he said on Twitter afterwards, he said something like, I had to defend the Geordie badge and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, it's all part of that. It's all part of
He's
that.
He's an adopted stuff. Geordie then.
Well, you know, you know.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at UH1.com.
There is all that, and having sort of criticised Alan Pardew, I should also say that, you know, Martin O'Neill saying that there was a delegation, or he'd heard that there was a delegation that had visited the referee's room at half time to sort of complain, that's not true.
I wanted to get you on that, because you do this, I'm sure O'Neill will not get in trouble for it, but you do this, if you were to write something like this and it's not true without evidence, you could get sued. I could get sued. If you do this in a World Cup or in the context of the Champions League, you get a serious ban. This is a very serious allegation to make. Now, I suspect that in the Premier League, nothing will happen, right? He's not going to get charged.
Well, I wouldn't have thought. I mean, the way he expressed it was in mitigation for Catenol sending off at the final whistle. We had heard that, you know, blah blah blah. Don't know what was said, but decision seemed to go Newcastle's way in the second half. That, you know, that sort of thing.
That's really bad.
From speaking to people at both clubs, what may have happened is that a Newcastle official wanted to get clarification on the Woodman thing being sent to the stand, but he didn't try and get access to the referee's room or anything like that. So you can sort of see how that misunderstanding might have arisen, and it kind of made for two lively press conferences afterwards. But, you know, I guess that's always the danger about sticking microphones in people's faces so quickly after the final whistle, after a game like that. People say things that maybe they wouldn't do 20 minutes, half an hour later, you know, but it fills the papers.
Matt, you've been silent throughout this, I guess, because you've been sort of processing information, and even though you are from the North, you're a neutral in this one, so you get the last word. Who's done a better job this year, Alan Pardew or Martin O'Neill?
Well, tough question. They've both done great jobs. I think per game, you'd have to say O'Neill, given the position of the team when he took them over, and he's only been there for a shorter space of time. Over the course of the season, it will probably end up being Pardew, as Newcastle look well placed to finish sixth or seventh, which would be a great achievement.
Did Calkin he answer that question correctly?
Yeah, I mean, it's in some, you know, why compare them, really? I mean, if Newcastle get into the top six or seven, it's an absolutely brilliant achievement against all sort of expectation, anticipation at the start of the season. And, you know, equally, O'Neill has had a brilliant effect on Sunderland since they came in. It's really heartening to see that sort of relationship restored between team and supporters. He's done that very well, and you know, from my perspective, long may it continue for both. I mean, I know Sunderland are not in the top 10 at the moment, but they have been, and it's nice to have the sort of the backdrop to a derby, the sort of notion that the two clubs could be lifting each other up as opposed to dragging each other down, which is how it's been for far too long.
and you get that synergy going, and maybe it's Middlesbrough who get lifted next.
That would be great. That would be great. And Tony Mowbray, what a fantastic bloke. And, you know, the same thing there, doing a very, very, very difficult job, but doing really well. Yeah, I would love that.
Tony Mowbray, of course, has been a guest before on the Game Podcast, and that's why we officially recognize him as one of our Warriors of the Light. From Warriors of the Light to Princes of Darkness, Tottenham Hotspur and Manchester United. Matt, I want to start with you. This seemed like an obvious game where Tottenham go out there and there's no Gareth Bale and no Scott Parker, and they play United off the park, I thought, largely speaking, and yet they lose. Does that sum it up?
Well, yeah, they had the first hour, but they didn't have the last final 30 minutes, and they didn't convert their chances in the final third of the pitch, which is why they lost the game and are now one and truly out of the title race and looking over their shoulders to Arsenal and, well, probably not Chelsea, but they are certainly looking to consolidate further rather than aim any higher. It's been a bad week for Harry, really. He's still the man of the moment, and there's linked with all these jobs that come up, but two heavy defeats to Arsenal and United have exposed Spurs a bit and maybe revealed them to be not quite as good as we thought they were.
George, did you ever believe that Tottenham could finish in the top two?
Well, if I say yes, I'd sound like an idiot, wouldn't I, now?
Well... Yeah, ooh, this is like therapy. We need you to be honest, so it doesn't work.
No, I didn't. I mean, I've kind of always thought it was. I mean, from the start, I've always thought it was the two Manchester clubs fighting it out. I mean, I think, like I'm sure a lot of people, when Tottenham have played well, they've probably been the most entertaining team to watch this season, and I've enjoyed that. But you know, it's not a great insight, really. But you know, that's Man United doing what Man United have been doing for 15 years and longer. They have that experience, even though they've got kind of younger generation of players and always coming through. They just know how to win games and win the important games. And I guess that's still something that Tottenham have to acquire.
Alison, do you buy that argument? This whole like. Winning ugly thing from.
I don't.
Was it
think,
not winning ugly?
I don't think. I don't think.
Thing.
Yeah, no. I don't think Man United won ugly at all.
No.
It's been a season where most people say, you know, Man United could win the title, and yet it's probably the worst team Ferguson's ever had.
That's me you're talking about.
Well, a lot of people have said that. I think it's because they're a team that lack a particularly gorgeous character like Cantona or Beckham or someone that everyone can focus on and say, wow, what a star, you know, the heartbeat
Rooney's
of the team
good,
and so on.
No, I mean,
well, I don't think people are as in love with Rooney, and he does boil hot and cold, and that's not a phrase, is it? He does run hot and cold.
Boils hot and cold, that's impressive.
They are very functional, Manchester United. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Everyone who's been in football a long time says you build from the back. You have to win a game by knowing exactly what everyone's role is. Your defence has to be good. And I think the defence against a very attacking Spurs team, you could argue, were a work of art in themselves. I mean, I think De Gea had an excellent game. Ferdinand probably played as well as he's played all season. And these are the sort of performances you need when you're away from home playing against a team that they had one bad game at the Emirates. That Tottenham are still a force to be reckoned with at White Hart Lane, and they did exactly the right thing. Man United didn't play ugly. They played very sensibly, and Ashley Young's goals were just as good as Robin van Persie's, and he's been getting all the accolades as being the striker of the season. So I don't think it was playing ugly. I think it was incredibly sensible, patient, and Spurs were bound to lose patience as the game wore on, and they did.
I thought United were outplayed, actually, and it was a smash and grab, and it's what you need to do to win
three,
titles.
What,
I guess.
I don't think 3-1 is a smash and grab.
Yeah, it is. When De Gea has to make that ridiculous save, when
He's part of the team. He's part of the team. If he's that rubbish, then you're leaking more goals, aren't you?
No, but I mean, look, the Spurs are a good team. I mean, who played very well. United, I thought, didn't play great, but, you know, obviously much tougher mentally, and, you know, got the breaks in their direction. Am I completely wrong on this, Matt, George? Somebody help me.
Well, they can't do this week after week, month after month. You know, they can't be crap week after week, month after month, and then still be second or top of the league, I think is the point. Is that,
well, they can if the league is actually pretty crappy there. I mean, I've said this before.
Yeah, no,
like, it's a really bad season at the top.
Absolutely, you can make that argument. But I suppose what I'm saying is you can look at individual games and say, well, okay, Tottenham played better, but United won. United are winning. I mean, that's what they're doing. They're doing it enough to be in the top two of the Premier League. So it isn't over the course of a season. It's not a fluke. It's not a
No. I wouldn't suggest at all that it's a fluke. And in fact, I think it's a bit like, in some ways, I think it's a bit like last season when they're showing that they can keep winning. And to go back to the Villas-Boas argument, you know, people say, like, well, how's he supposed to freshen up the team and keep winning? It's impossible. Well, you know what? Has anybody seen the players that Sir Alex Ferguson has signed over the last 18 months? You know, from Chicharito to Jones, to bringing back Cleverley, to bringing back Welbeck, to Ashley Young. He is freshening up the side, to Smalling. And guess what? They're still winning titles and finishing second. So it is possible, right?
He's been in the job for 26 years, which is nearly as long as Andre Villas-Boas has been alive. So
okay, well, fair enough,
can't,
but I mean,
really compare the situations.
You know what? Also, but just because you're old doesn't mean you're good. Gary Megson's old too.
It means you have authority and respect and time and patience, all of the things that Villas-Boas lacked, which is why he was doomed to fail.
But also Ferguson still has a, you know, is still the pivotal figure when it comes to buying players, and I'm not kind of jumping onto the sort of managers union here, but you can't hoard players like sort of trophy assets and all that sort of stuff. There has to be team building, and that's what, you know, that's what United have done.
And shouldn't really have Chelsea signed a manager, brought in a manager who was incredibly good in the transfer market if you want an overhaul job?
They should have brought a director of football. Managers shouldn't be making decisions like that. It should be director of football. Continental model, damn it! Moving on! And remember, this Wednesday, we have a special game podcast bonus. Allison, George, myself, we're all joined by Dan Johnson, the Premier League's Director of Communications. So if you ever wondered what a Premier League director sounds like, this is your opportunity. We're going to be talking some of the stuff clubs do in the community. We're going to be talking a little bit about the Football Data Co. and that ridiculous policy that they have. Sorry, editorializing here. And a bit about broadcasting and TV. So that'll be game podcast bonus on Wednesday. All right, time now for some quick hits. Liverpool play Arsenal off the park, but end up losing 2-1. Allison, should Dalglish be more pleased with the performance or more angry with the result?
Well, anger's not very productive, is it? I think his overwhelming feeling ought to be one of jealousy that Arsenal had in their team a striker who is just incredibly clinical. And I think it's very worrying for Dalglish, actually, that Liverpool could play that well. 13-0 corner count, something like that. And consistently, particularly at home, aren't able to convert the chances they should.
I think anger can be extremely productive, finally.
No.
Robin van Persie scores 2 in that game, and it brings his season total up to 31. He got massive plaudits for the way he struck that last gasp winner. But, George, am I insane for suggesting that maybe Pepe Reina could have done better?
No, you're insane for every other reason.
Thank you. And to elaborate upon that, he does very well to square his body to the right angle and guide the shot, but he didn't hit it particularly hard, it's in your near post.
No, goalkeeper likes to be beaten at the near post, do they?
Yeah, I thought Van Persie's goal at Everton, certainly in the strike, was much, much better, personally. Super Mario Balotelli has a late night on Thursday, but then scores in City's 2-0 win over Bolton. In fact, he could have had two or three hat tricks in that game. Mancini says that if Balotelli's found to have broken curfew, he'll be punished. Matt, is this really necessary, given that it did not seem to affect him on the pitch?
Yeah, it is. It is necessary because Mario seems to behave as he wants and needs to learn to respect the rules. Clubs have curfews and alcohol policies for a pretty good reason. And if they hadn't been playing a modest team at home, they could have easily needed Balotelli to produce more, and he would may not have been able to. So yeah, he needs to grow up and start behaving like a high-level professional.
But he's a big star. He should be treated with kid gloves, like a big star. And forget it. No, I'm with you. Dave Whelan helpfully announces that he wants an explanation from Roberto Martinez as to why he left out three, quote, quality players in Wigan's 2-0 home defeat to Swansea. And if you're wondering who those three quality players are, it's Rodallega, Victor Moses, and Diame. All three, of course, came on in the second half. Allison, is it a good idea when owners tell the world they're on a mission for answers and they'll be grilling their own managers? Is Whelan part of the solution here or part of the problem?
Well, Martinez is in this surprising position of being perceived as the most secure manager of those in the bottom half of the table because of this sort of relationship he has with the owner, that he was offered the Villa job, decided, no, I'm going to be loyal, and everyone expects that means there'll be loyalty in return. I think if Whelan believes that perception is not healthy at the moment and there needs to be a bit of pressure put on his manager, then in a strange way, it probably was quite helpful.
Alex Horn, the FA's secretary, has come out and said that England might not appoint a manager until the end of the season. George, is this a clever idea? Why or do I get this horrid feeling that Stuart Pearce is going to lead out England at the Euros? And if that happens, should the villagers storm Wembley armed with pitchforks and torches?
Well, I have to be honest. England broke my heart somewhere between Germany and South Africa, so I'm struggling to get sort of terribly worked up about it. I find the idea of Stuart Pearce being the manager at the Euros so funny that I almost want it to happen, just for the hell of it. And I mean, even if he did get it, I don't think it would have much effect either way. Seriously, is it a clever idea to wait until the end of the season? Well, they'll find it far more difficult to get a manager who's in work now than they would at the end of the season. So I suppose there's a logic there. There also aren't any England games, but am I bothered? Not really.
This is the problem. This is the problem working with these cynics, because, of course, you know, Calkin's fallen out of love with England. Hughes, as anybody can probably guess, has never been an England fan. And Alison, you bleed red, right? Not for the Cross of St. George?
Correct.
There you go. I am probably the biggest England fan here.
Yeah.
Just as we thought Terry Connor's appointment could be the kind of outside-the-box thinking that helps Wolves stay up, they go and lose to Fulham, 5-0. Hughesy, your choice. You can talk about how bad Wolves are and how really the PL should consider relegating the bottom five teams this year instead of the customary three. Or you can simply talk about how stunning Pavel Pogrebnik's hat-trick was and how Clint Dempsey can't stop scoring.
Well, Dempsey's having a great season and Fulham are doing well, which pleases me, as it's making Mark Hughes look very silly, given he said they're a small club with no ambition. But I'll probably go with the former, to be honest. I'd relegate the bottom six.
Bottom six? With. That includes Villa?
Yeah, get rid of Villa. They're terrible. Have you been to Villa Park this year? It's a miserable experience. Blackburn, Bolton, Wolves, QPR, Wigan, Villa, gone.
There you go. Bad Samoa. That's it. And let's go and let's have an 18-team Premier League. I've been arguing this forever. You know, when I become Dan Johnson's boss, I'm going to come out, and that's exactly what
and
I'm going to do.
Give everybody free fixture lists, probably.
Exactly.
Gab, here's one for you. Why is Swiss football in such a pickle right now?
Because they may be really, really good at, like, you know, making clocks and chocolate and cows and taking your money and hiding it from the tax authorities elsewhere. But evidently, when it comes to oversight of football clubs, they're actually really, really rubbish. There's 10 teams in the Swiss Super League, and Super League, of course, seems like like a really silly term. There were 10 at the start of the season. There will only be 8 at the end of the season because 2 of them went bankrupt and stopped fulfilling their fixtures halfway through the season. And another one is Sion. Those crazy people started suing everybody in the world and got a 36-point penalty. And I now have -1 points in the table. It's an absolute sort of lunatic asylum, the Swiss Super League, and it's just so out of step with the rest of the country. I love it. It's funny. That's all we've got time for this week. But remember, you can go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis. You can follow us on Twitter. You can do our web chats. My web chat is on Tuesdays. George, you still do that lovely Northeast web chat?
No.
Okay. No more George Culkin.
Bring it back.
But you can follow him at Culkin That Times. Matt, have you been roped into a web chat?
Occasionally.
Okay, so he's occasional. I'm on Tuesdays. You get Rory Smith on Mondays, and Ollie Kay is seemingly every single day, every single moment of the week. So please stay in touch with us, and till next week. Bye-bye.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.